is a nightmare for people in Gaza, because he's been very clear during the Biden-Trump debate, the presidential debate, that Israel wants to carry on and continue this war indefinitely, and he's willing to indulge in that, to let them finish the job, as he said. That is basically, when I talk to people in Gaza, they react with immense fear about a second Trump term. But unexpected thing for sure is that he's going to empower every fundamentalist, lunatic, extremist, right-wing hawk to put them in charge of Middle East peace, as he did during his first term. He put a messianic Israeli-American settler, David Friedman from Beit Eil, he put him as the American ambassador to Israel to take what was termed at the time the sledgehammer policy, destroy everything that would be there to enable a Palestinian state to be established, expand settlements, recognize settlements as not necessarily illegal under international law, remove the labeling of settlement products,
Mohammed, we have 10 seconds.
And defund hospitals. But the problem is that Biden administration hasn't been any better in many ways. The last 3 years have been the deadliest there is in Palestinian-Israeli relations since records began in 2005.
Mohammed Shahada, I want to thank you for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, columnist for The Forward newspaper, a Jewish weekly in New York. That does it for our broadcast. We have a job opening of development director in charge of fundraising at Democracy Now! Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Milwaukee.
Thank you. Thank you. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, this is Democracy Now!
There's no place in America for this kind of violence, for any violence, ever. Period. No exceptions. We can't allow this violence to be normalized.
President Biden's calling for national unity after a gunman attempted to assassinate Donald Trump during a rally in Pennsylvania. A bullet grazed Trump's ear, leaving him bloodied. On Sunday, Trump arrived here in Milwaukee, where the Republican National Convention begins today. We'll speak with Jeff Charlotte, author of The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Then, also here in Milwaukee, the Poor People's Army set up an unhoused encampment Sunday. The group plans to march to the RNC today.
So the Poor People's Army and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign has been to every RNC and DNC marching and demonstrating and standing up for families that are low income for 30-something years. So we will continue until the needs are met and until the very wealthy pay their fair share of taxes so that everybody can have what they need.
We'll also speak to Sherry Honkala of the Poor People's Army, which has set up an unhoused encampment here in Milwaukee. The group plans to march to the RNC, and we'll speak to Wisconsin-born journalist Dan Kaufman, author of The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The FBI is attempting to pin down a motive after the assassination attempt against former President Donald Trump Saturday. The shooting took place during a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania.
You want to really see something that said, take a look at what happened.
A bullet grazed Trump's ear, leaving him bloodied. 50-year-old Corey Comparator, a volunteer firefighter and spectator, was killed as he attempted to protect his family from the gunfire. Two other spectators are in critical condition. Secret Service fatally shot the gunman, 20-year-old Thomas Matthew Crooks, seconds after he opened fire. The Justice Department is investigating the shooting as an act of domestic terrorism. Investigators believe Crooks acted alone when he shot an AR-15 towards the rally stage from atop a nearby building just minutes into Trump's speech. Some attendees say they spotted the gunman climbing to the roof and attempted to get law enforcement's attention to intervene. Moments after a bullet grazed Trump's ear, a photographer from the Associated Press snapped a photo of a bloodied Trump raising his fist with an image of a U.S. flag behind him. Many online commentators are speculating the incident in the image will help Trump's reelection bid. President Joe Biden ordered a review of the rally's security. He addressed the nation from the Oval Office Sunday evening.
There's no place in America for this kind of violence, for any violence, ever. Period. No exceptions. We can't allow this violence to be normalized. You know, the political record in this country has gotten very heated. It's time to cool it down. We all have a responsibility to do that. Yes, we have deeply felt strong disagreements. The stakes in this election are enormously high.
Trump arrived here in Milwaukee on Sunday for the Republican National Convention, where he is expected to take the stage tonight. In Gaza, Israel killed at least 91 Palestinians and injured 300 others when it bombed the coastal area of Al-Mawasi near Khan Yunis Saturday. Hundreds of thousands of Gazans have been staying in the designated safe zone of Al-Mawasi after fleeing other areas, including Rafah. This is a survivor of the slaughter.
When the airstrike started, we saw missiles, so we started to run. They saved me. I got injured. My children and my wife and my family members are injured. The first missile were fired like rain towards us, then a minute between each missile. They fired too many missiles towards the people. Why this strike? It should be a safe zone. We were at Al-Mawasi, a safe zone.
Israel claimed it was targeting Hamas leader Mohammed Deif, but Deif's fate remains unclear 2 days later, and Hamas claims he survived the attack. The UN and others condemned the massacre. The Council on American-Islamic Relations said, quote, President Biden's continuing support for and silence about the genocide gives a green light for more Israeli abuses and war crimes, Kerr said. But Israel's slaughter continues unabated. On Sunday, Israeli missiles targeted another UNRWA school in the Nuseirat refugee camp, killing at least 22 people. Many of those who were sheltering at the UN school arrived after receiving evacuation orders from Israel at their previous locations. Deadly strikes have also been reported at the Magasi and Perej refugee camps. Meanwhile, rescue workers say they found at least 60 bodies under the rubble of the Shujaya neighborhood of Gaza City following Israel's withdrawal from the area last week after leaving it in ruins. On Sunday, Hamas confirmed ceasefire talks are still ongoing. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on the international community to ensure the survival of UNRWA, the UN agency assisting Palestine refugees amidst ongoing attacks from Israel. Guterres spoke at a conference in New York where 118 UN members asserted their commitment to keeping UNRWA running, at least through September.
And my appeal to everyone is this: protect UNRWA. Protect UNRWA's staff and protect UNRWA's mandate, including through funding. And let me be clear, there is no alternative to UNRWA. And UNRWA is also being targeted in other ways. Staff have been subject to increasingly violent protests and virulent misinformation and disinformation campaigns. Some have been detained by Israeli security forces and subsequently reported mistreatment and even torture.
The UN Secretary General Guterres added, UNRWA is often the main source of hope for Gazans as they're, quote, forced to move like human pinballs across a landscape of destruction and death, unquote. The U.S. was previously UNRWA's largest donor, but Congress passed a bill this year banning funding to the agency until March of next year. At least 195 UNRWA workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. A Syrian soldier was killed Sunday after Israel launched fresh strikes in and around Damascus. Israel's military said it had targeted a Syrian military command center as well as other infrastructure in response to two drones that were fired toward Israel from Syrian territory. This comes as parliamentary elections are taking place in Syria today, which could pave the way for a constitutional amendment to extend the term of President Bashar al-Assad. This is the fourth election that's been held in Syria since the war began in 2011. Officials from Sudan's warring parties are in Geneva, Switzerland, for UN-led talks aimed at brokering a possible ceasefire between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces, as well as open access to humanitarian aid for civilians. The violence has left tens of thousands dead and displaced over 10 million people since April of last year. The UN says about 26 million people, slightly more than half the population of Sudan, is facing high levels of acute food insecurity. In Somalia, at least 9 people were killed after a car bomb was detonated outside a cafe in the capital Mogadishu Sunday as people gathered to watch the Euro 2024 soccer finals. Some 20 others were wounded in the explosion. Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for Sunday's deadly attack. In Bolivia, union leaders marched on the capital, La Paz, Friday in support of the leftist president, Luis Arce, after he survived a failed military coup attempt last month. Arce addressed supporters at the March for Democracy.
Behind a coup, there are always economic interests. And in our country, we've always had to face coups as others wanted to take our natural resources from us. For strategy and geopolitics, they wanted to take what is for us, the engine of development and growth of the families here in our country.
Finland has passed a bill that allows authorities to turn away asylum seekers at its border, a move immigration and rights groups warn is a violation of international law. This comes after Finland last year closed all its land crossings with Russia amidst mounting tensions since Moscow invaded Ukraine. Finland joined NATO last year after decades of pursuing a military policy of non-alignment. And in New Mexico, a judge dismissed involuntary manslaughter charges against Alec Baldwin in the fatal 2021 shooting of cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the set of the Western Rust. Baldwin, the film's star and producer, fired the loaded prop gun that killed Hutchins and injured director Joel Souza. The judge's dismissal Friday ended Baldwin's trial just 2 days after it opened and came after Baldwin's defense accused the prosecution of concealing evidence favorable to Baldwin. Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, the film's weapons handler, who's serving 18 months in prison after being convicted earlier this year, said she'll also seek to have her case dismissed in light of the decision. Meanwhile, the family of Helena Hutchins vowed to pursue their civil case against those involved in the deadly shooting. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from the Republican Convention in Milwaukee. When we come back, we'll speak to Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. He was planning to go to that rally in Pennsylvania, though he didn't end up going. That's where President Trump ended up being shot. We'll talk about the significance of this and what this means for politics in this country. Stay with us.
This is for all the lonely people thinking that life has passed them by. Don't give up until you drink from the silver cup and ride that highway in the sky. This is for all the single people
Lonely People by America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's calling for national unity after Saturday's attempted assassination of Donald Trump. The former president was shot near the ear during an outdoor rally in Butler, Pennsylvania. One attendee of the rally was shot dead, two others critically wounded. The gunman was also shot dead by Secret Service. On Sunday night, President Biden gave a primetime address from the Oval Office.
There is no place in America for this kind of violence, for any violence ever. Period. No exceptions. We can't allow this violence to be normalized. You know, the political record in this country has gotten very heated. It's time to cool it down. We all have a responsibility to do that. Yes, we have deeply felt strong disagreements. The stakes in this election are enormously high.
The FBI is continuing to investigate Saturday's shooting. Authorities have identified the gunman as 20-year-old Thomas Matthew Crooks, who lived in the Pittsburgh suburb of Bethel Park, not far from where the rally took place. Investigators believe Crooks acted alone, but have not yet determined a motive. The AR-15 used in the attack had been purchased by his father. Secret Service snipers shot Crooks dead soon after he opened fire. Part of the investigation centers on how the gunman managed to get on top of a nearby building located about 400 feet away from the stage with a direct line of sight on the stage. Some Republicans directly cast blame on the Biden campaign. Republican Senator of Ohio J.D. Vance, being considered a top vice presidential running mate of Trump's, tweeted, "Today is not just some isolated incident. The central premise of the Biden campaign is that President Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs. That rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination," J.D. Vance tweeted. Joining us now is journalist and author Jeff Charlotte. He's a professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College. His latest book is The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. You were planning to be at that rally in Butler, Pennsylvania?
But for logistics go I. I had planned to go and report the rally and didn't work out. So I was kind of keeping tabs on it during the day and watching the misery of the heat and people crying, "Medic, medic, medic." It was really kind of a bad scene already. And then, of course, came the shooting.
You posted on social media, "Calling Trump a threat to democracy is in no way violent rhetoric." Can you take it from there? I mean, you have this situation where Trump was injured, his right ear grazed. He'll be speaking at the Republican convention tonight. One man was killed. Another two are critically injured. The shooter was shot. It is unclear how the Secret Service clearing the site, which was a large field where only this building overlooked it, overlooked this building, even as spectators were pointing to him climbing up the side of the building and then on the roof and saying, "There's a shooter there." This is before he opened fire.
Yes, and I think to connect that to the idea of calling Trump a threat to democracy is the depth of cynicism. And I'll go and take up Senator Vance's challenge, too. Trump is a fascist authoritarian. That's a threat he poses. Naming that doesn't call for violence. It calls for a vibrant democratic response. And I think in some ways what's dismaying is this kind of tit for tat. Was the gunman a Republican, or was he motivated by some delusional version of what he imagined were left ideas? The clear division line here for that gunman, for that kind of action, is between violence and democracy. An assassin is anti-democracy. He is pro-violence. And Trump is speaking as a candidate for a pro-violent movement that speaks explicitly and frequently and openly. And I didn't go to Butler, but I've been to plenty of Trump rallies. And the invocation of violence is a constant drumbeat there. So the depth of the cynicism of the idea that defending democracy is somehow calling for violence is kind of a new low for the Trump campaign. And that's saying something.
I want to play for you, Jeff, a recent comment by North Carolina's Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who's running to be governor and is planning to speak this week here at the Republican National Convention. This is Robinson speaking at a church in North Carolina last month.
"You know, it was a time when we used to meet evil on the battlefield, and guess what we did to it? We killed it. We didn't quibble about it. We didn't argue about it. We didn't fight about it. We killed it." Some liberal somewhere is going to say that sounds awful. Too bad. Get mad at me if you want to. Some folks need killing. It's time for somebody to say it.
Some folks need killing, Jeff Charlotte. Robinson is expected to be speaking here at the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, I was thinking about him this weekend. I was thinking about Representative Clay Higgins of Louisiana, recently elevated by Mike Johnson to the Armed Services Committee, despite the fact that last year he called for basically full-on militia resistance to the Biden administration. I was thinking about the megachurches that I encountered traveling the country for the undertow that are forming militias, that are actually are forming militias that are armed. I was thinking about a church in Omaha, Nebraska, led by a prominent religious backer of Trump, where I was escorted out at gunpoint for asking questions. So I don't like to do the thing like you did at first. Instead, I think what we need to look at and sort of say is that the Trump campaign and this kind of authoritarianism is driven by not just the use of violence, not just the invocation of violence, but a kind of reverence for violence, a redemption through violence. You look at Project 2025, which we've all heard about now, and I think one of the things that hasn't been talked about enough is begins with four pillars, the principles that they're moving forward. Number one is protect the children, language that they're taking directly almost from QAnon. The idea, it's an invocation of innocence. And again and again, at Trump rallies and Trump's rhetoric, you hear the idea of their innocence, which therefore justifies any violence in response. That's calling that dangerous is not an incitement to violence. It's an incitement to build a vibrant democratic culture that can push back against that nightmare dream.
So you raised the Project 2025, and not everyone may know what it is, this 922-page blueprint written by the Heritage Foundation for radically reshaping the federal government along what critics describe as authoritarian and Christian nationalist lines. The document proposing attacking unions, climate action, universal health care, abortion access, and more. Now, in recent weeks, Donald Trump has tried to distance himself from Project 2025, even though many of his advisors helped write it. He wrote on social media, quote, "I know nothing about Project 2025. I have no idea who's behind it. I disagree with some of the things they're saying, and some of the things they're saying are absolutely ridiculous and abysmal. Anything they do, I wish them luck, but I have nothing to do with them." However, in 2022, Trump openly praised the Heritage Foundation's work.
Yeah, the denial, Trump's attempts to distance himself is just silly. But on the other hand, I also want us to look at it as kind of media bait, because then we're going to spend a lot of time.
Jeff, it's too important to hear, since Trump is so frequently now denying he knows anything about Project 2025. Going back to 2022, let's play Trump.
Our country is going to hell. The critical job of institutions such as Heritage is to lay the groundwork, and Heritage does such an incredible job at that. This is a great group, and they're going to lay the groundwork and detail plans for exactly what our movement will do and what your movement will do when the American people give us a colossal mandate to save America. And that's coming. That's coming.
So that was in 2022. It came. The Project 2025 is out. And even as we broadcast today in Milwaukee, one of the events that's being held is by the Heritage Foundation. So if you could talk further about that and compare that 922-page document to the much shorter, less than 20-page Republican platform that has just been put out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that Trump's denials and saying, "I don't have anything to do with this document," that several dozen of his senior former aides have put together, is absurd and silly. But on the other hand, we also don't have to doubt that Trump is telling the truth in only one regard. He did not read a 900-page document. The document for Trump and the strongman authoritarianism, the document serves Trump. He doesn't serve the document. And I think that's what he's saying. That's the message his people are getting. And he's even able to say some of it he finds ridiculous. One of the things that's been called attention to is the document calls for banning pornography. Trump's not going to ban pornography. He has Amber Rose, the founder of OnlyFans, as a speaker at the rally. He's going to be introduced by Dana White, the CEO of the Ultimate Fighting Organization. Blood and sex is part of the rally, right? But if you look closer at Project 2025 and the way that document works and the way it creates a blueprint, not just for his action, but for what we might think of the thousands of little Trumps that trickle down from the top all through the administration, starting with the replacement of the civil service, which is one of the things that it outlines. You look at the banning of pornography. They defining pornography as transgender ideology. So, this is an attack on trans people. They're defining as librarians who distribute pornography, librarians who distribute regular books, Alison Bechdel's Fun Home or Genderqueer. Suddenly, those people are subject to criminal prosecution. Now we see the project and we see how the project aligns with the Trumpist movement. But you raised the RNC, the Republican platform, 16 pages, which is very, very short. These platforms are usually long, verbose documents, and they're sort of stuffed with every interest group of the party, and they don't really mean too much. Trump's actually means something. Trump actually wrote some of it himself. You can tell because of the all caps, and you can tell because of the language, which distills that 900 pages of the Project 2025 to a very angry and weirdly exuberant vision of vengeance, of pushing back, and very clearly of Christian nationalism. It talks about religious freedom and defines it as a fight against persecution of American Christians. That's the vision. In fact, it promises, the 16-page document promises to set up a special organization to save Christians in America. And if you're saving Christians, by far the dominant group, you need an enemy. You need somebody to save them from. And that's where we get into the fascist imagination of the enemy within.
Professor Charlotte, we just have a minute. Can you talk about him? We've been talking about Reagan in today's. We've been doing an expanded 2 one-hour shows edition, talking about the fact that going back to 1981, right, there was an attempted assassination of him. But when you look at the Heritage Foundation and what it's been doing in presenting hundreds of pages of a kind of blueprint for an administration, they went back to the Reagan administration. Is that right?
The Heritage Foundation, this major right-wing think tank, really made its bones in Washington by producing a similar document for Reagan in 1980. And so Project 2025 isn't without precedent, but what it is not so much a merger of Reaganism and Trumpism, but sort of it's Trumpism fully absorbing Reaganism, tucking it in to the side, pushing, burying it under the kind of the Trumpish concerns of vengeance, of a kind of a purified nation. And this is not to defend Reagan, that Reagan mandate, which was a kind of real nightmare vision of America as well. But that kind of final consolidation of the Republican Party into the Trump Party is what this document signifies.
Jeff Charlotte, want to thank you for being with us, journalist, author, professor of English and creative writing at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. His latest book is The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Milwaukee, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump arrived here on Sunday ahead of the opening day today of the Republican convention. Trump's expected to take the stage tonight, 2 days after he survived an attempted assassination. A number of protests are scheduled for today. Organizers of the march on the RNC say they plan to go ahead with the protest that's been scheduled for months. This is Omar Flores.
Well, nothing really changes for us, you know. I will say that Trump breeds a lot of hate. He encourages this type of thing. But we're going to continue with the family-friendly march. The shooting has nothing to do with us, really. Well, when this happens, you know, we just think a lot of what Trump has encouraged throughout his presidency and throughout his time in politics. And, you know, we think of, for example, related to our point of unity around immigrant rights. I mean, the deaths at the border, the kids in cages, you know, the countless lives that, you know, didn't have to go away. You know, that's what we're thinking about right now. The fact that he moved the Israeli embassy, you know, to Jerusalem, I mean, that stoked tensions. That definitely caused some death. You know, I mean, just look at anything related to the extreme right, and, you know, that's what we're looking at in terms of violence. And so, you know, we'll just say that, you know, Trump encourages this type of behavior.
On Sunday, dozens of people set up an unhoused encampment just minutes from FISR Forum, where the RNC is being held, to protest policies that exacerbated poverty and a housing crisis nationwide. The encampment organized by the Poor People's Army, which is planning a separate march outside the RNC later this afternoon. On Sunday, Democracy Now! Spoke to participants as they set up the unhoused encampment.
When people start arriving with tents, they can just start to fill them, right? Just fill the land.
My name is Sandra Rivera-Colon, and we're currently in Milwaukee. We are setting up an encampment. We call it a tent city. This has been a part of my life for 28 years of my life. And I was born in a tent city in Philadelphia in 96. And since then, like, my entire life has revolved around, you know, helping and to end poverty and homelessness. We've done multiple encampments just to get people's attention within the cities, and this is my mom.
Tara Colon. What it means to be in this encampment during the RNC for us means putting a face to the poverty. Okay, poverty doesn't discriminate in the United States. It doesn't matter whether you're a brand new baby, because she was born literally. I walked from tent city to the hospital because that was my struggle for housing when I was pregnant with my daughter. It's also the face of our 80-year-old elders that have either fought in American wars or who help change laws because they marched down civil rights. And now they're homeless at the age of 80, at the age of 75, or they're doing Uber when they should be retired and enjoying and being taken care of the way they took care of this country, not just their families. Instead of going and walking behind the Walmart, which is what nobody will ever do, instead of going down the street, that in every single city and in every single small town, and when I say small, I'm talking about like inky-dinky towns, there are tent cities all over the United States because nobody has a place to live.
It's Rita Maniotis, and I'm with the Greater Milwaukee Green Party. And we've been, just the basic needs of people are not being met, and that's what they are marching about, that poor people are being ignored in this society. The only people, it's almost as if they're treated as if it's their own fault. And they are the victims of this economic system. It's not the other way around, that they are victimizing the people that have the money. So I think that it's important for poor people to be recognized.
My name is Anita Williams, and I'm from Philadelphia. I had a son that got shot 4 years ago in Philadelphia. He's okay, but he's still got barriers and stuff like this that's going on. He have nightmares. So I want this world to be better. It's really, really hard, especially if you're doing it by yourself and you're a single parent and you have children. It's really, really hard. And a lot of people don't understand because a lot of people are not homeless. I mean, homeless, you know what I mean? And a lot of people ain't been hungry. That I guess they figured it out. But it's really, really hard that you see your children being hungry, or, you know, you're not eating, your children got to eat, or it might be certain things your children want to eat and they can't eat because you can't afford it. President. What I'd like to see the president do is help homelessness, stop the war, and help people with hunger. People have been hungry, put more jobs out here, open facilities for homelessness. I mean, you know, that and mental health. A lot of people sick, you know, and help them out, and I think that'll help a whole lot if the president would do that.
Good evening, my name is Ken Juan Redding. What brings me here is it's like an epidemic with the drug crisis, big pharma. I mean, the drug crisis is spreading like coronavirus. You know what I mean? For all the money that's being flooded into the economy in the United States and through politicians, it shouldn't be as bad as it is. There's fentanyl, people dying from fentanyl left and right. It's not current attitude. You know what I mean? You have money for all these debates and these penthouses and they're coming up with big houses all over here, but we don't have anything for drug rehabilitation and drug education. You know, it's like it's not, they don't care about us, you know. Especially, it's basically, we're paychecks.
You know, at the RNC, there's a lot of pharmaceutical lobbies and lobbying happening. What is your message to them?
Well, if they're getting these billions of dollars for every new medicine that they create, you should have build a facility that can combat the overdose. So just as fast as they can create these different medications, create facilities that can help them. Help me help you. If you can't help us, then what is your purpose?
I'm Rosa Richards. I'm 15. We've been homeless many times. It's hard. It's hard for families to be homeless and try to get off the streets. Houses need to be built. There's empty plots. Like, I live in Athol, Mass. There's empty plots everywhere. And there's many homeless people. Philly. Addictions. People need that, but putting them in jail is not going to help at all. That's all I'm saying. They need better systems. I would like to see that Trump and Biden back off and a better president go in. Like, someone needs to actually do the stuff they said they would do.
My name is Lisa Richards. I'm a mother of 7 children. So we arrived a few days ago. We drove. And then we'll go home. And then we'll come back again and be in Chicago. So we've been doing this for 30 years, and we will continue until poor people have what they need and the rich pay their fair share.
What motivates you to keep coming back here for 30 years?
So the Poor People's Army and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign has been to every RNC and DNC marching and demonstrating and standing up for families that are low income for 30-something years. So we will continue until the needs are met and until the very wealthy pay their fair share of taxes so that everybody can have what they need. Seniors should not be having to decide through diabetic medication or other medication they need or having a roof over their head or food in their mouths. It is not okay, because our children and our families and my mother and everybody's families deserve the best here in the United States. And if we're going to keep claiming that we're so great, then we should be the best we can be, and we're not. We're not. We just need to be real about that and stop trying to show off to other countries and tell other countries what to do and starting wars and spend the money on the people. The vets are out in the street. They're becoming addicted. We have high rates of addictions, not enough recovery programs, not enough mental health programs, lots of suicides. We need help, and we need it now. And it's our responsibility to do more than just vote every 4 years or every 2 years. And to be a true American, you should be active continuously.
Let's talk about, you know, what's happening now in Gaza and the forced starvation and famine and insane, tremendous death toll. You know, a lot of the signs here are also making connections.
Right. So the Poor People's Army is a national and international army. We've been a huge organization in international countries for many, many years. Sherry's been all over the place with lots of other people standing up for the people. So this is nothing new. So places like Gaza and anywhere else where people are getting killed, families, for doing absolutely nothing, you know, but trying to live and take care of their families with less than what we have, we should be ashamed of ourselves.
So I went down to the rich man's house, and I took back what he stole from me. I took back my
some of the voices from the unhoused encampment organized by the Poor People's Army. Special thanks to Hannah Elias and Hani Massoud. For more, we're joined here in Milwaukee by Sherry Hankala, the Poor People's Army National Spokesperson, National Coordinator of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It seems we interview you every convention. Talk about what your plans are here in Milwaukee.
Well, today at 4 p.m., we will gather where our encampment is at 4 p.m. At King Park, and we intend to walk with people that are currently homeless, that have their children with them, that have disabilities, and we're going to have a little mock trial. And if we determine that the Republicans are guilty for crimes against humanity, then we are going to issue a citizen's arrest and ask the law enforcement officials to arrest folks for crimes against humanity.
And talk about the encampment that you have set up yesterday. I mean, so far, hundreds of people have come through to it.
Yes, hundreds of people have arrived from different parts of the country. Right now, a guy spent 4 days riding Greyhound. An 80-year-old woman drove from Oregon. Mothers and their children have all arrived. We are putting our few pennies together, sharing them, taking care of each other, and we're prepared to go forward on this march because it's incredibly important, because people are not surviving poverty in this country. And we've set up our Poor People's Army. We did not declare this war, but we're here to fight it.
Can you talk about the recent Supreme Court decision, Grants Pass versus Johnson, what the ruling was around people who are unhoused?
Well, right now, we were absolutely devastated. We organized groups of homeless people and poor people from across the country, demonstrated in front of the Supreme Court, had many lawyers and cases across the country that were a part of the brief that was entered. And
this was a 6-3 ruling.
Yes.
Where the Supreme Court justices said local governments can criminalize sleeping and camping on public property, banning encampments of unhoused people. You had Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Jackson, who said Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in the minority, sleep's a biological necessity, not a crime. For some people, sleeping outside is their only option. For people with no access to shelter, that punishes them for being homeless. That is unconscionable and unconstitutional.
It's absolutely devastating, especially like in Philadelphia. There's huge waiting lists. Men, women, and children are turned away on a daily basis with no place to sleep. It doesn't matter if you have a disability. And we find this across the entire country, where there's more homeless people than there are abandoned properties. Cities are not housing people. And now the Supreme Court has criminalized homelessness in America.
Are you planning to march in Chicago on the Democratic National Convention?
Absolutely. We will be there on opening day again at 4 p.m. The city of Chicago made a mistake, a technical error. They didn't get back to us. And so we're the only group that has been granted a permit. So we are inviting every single group across the entire country that wants to have their voice heard.
And finally, in preparation for the Republican National Convention here in Milwaukee, how has the city dealt with unhoused people?
They continue to do their regular sweeps. People don't have access to affordable housing. Where we set up our encampment, there's other homeless people that have also just begun to set up their tents as a way to have some place to sleep as well. But it'll be very interesting to see how law enforcement deals with men, women, and children today. Hopefully, they will look at the fact that we have a long history of having peaceful marches, and will allow us to walk to the front doors of the RNC and issue our arrest warrants.
Well, I want to thank you very much for you being with us. Sherry Hankala of the Poor People's Army, national spokesperson, national coordinator of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Next up, we'll be joined by Wisconsin native Dan Kaufman, author of The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. Stay with us. Seahorse by Moondog. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for this 5 days of the Republican National Convention. We will bring you the voice